Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today, a topic not particularly sexy, not exciting, but that's all the more reason to discuss it because I know for me, I mentally avoid these topics, and then I am not as smart as I need to be to optimally treat my patients. So, new reversal agents for the novel oral anticoagulants or whatever the hell you want to call them. I'm certainly not smart enough to speak on this topic. I needed someone who in the Boston parlance is wicked smart on this stuff. And that person is Nadia Awad. She is the associate editor of the EM PharmD blog and has written literature on this topic and is the perfect person to discuss new agents for reversal of things I can't pronounce. And I will mispronounce them throughout the show. Don't send me emails or tweets. Let's get right to it. Why don't you tell us who you are and what you do?
So my name is Nadia Awad, and I'm an emergency medicine pharmacist. I practice at Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital, New Brunswick, New Jersey. I've been in emergency medicine for about 4 years now and loving every minute of it.
Fantastic. And we do love our emergency medicine pharmacists. Let's ask you some questions that are really specific to ED pharmacists. And it's reversal of these novel oral anticoagulants. I think that's the industry standard term that people are going with now. Is that right?
Yeah. Some people say target specific oral anticoagulants or SOACs, NOACs, whatever floats your boat.
All right. So why don't we talk first about dabigatran? Hopefully this agent will disappear. I find it annoying and difficult, but it's still out there to some extent. And I guess the setting we will talk about all these in is the patient with an intracranial bleed, because that's probably the most time critical of these. So if you have a patient on dabigatran and you got your CT and they have an intracerebral hemorrhage, how long after their last dose do we actually have to reverse this stuff?
So it's really hard to say in that setting of an intracranial bleed. A lot of times, you know, that when these patients present to the ED, the most common story that I hear is that, you know, the patients have had an unknown downtime and they just so happen to be on dabigatran. And it's really hard to tell based on, you know, the patient's condition. They may be comatose, intubated, sedated, when the last dose of dabigatran was taken. With that being said, however, peak effects following oral ingestion of dabigatran typically happen within 2 to 3 hours, and it has a half-life of about 12 to 14 hours, and most of it's eliminated through the kidneys. The other thing that we have to bear in mind is that some of these patients may be on agents that may potentially interact with dabigatran, and that can actually potentiate some of the anticoagulant effect. This is specific with dabigatran in terms of interacting with agents that are P-glycoprotein inhibitors. So we have those agents such as diltiazem, verapamil, quinidine, itraconazole, which are some of the common ones, as well as macrolides.
All right. So from what I'm understanding, timing their last dose as a way of avoiding reversal may not be the most clever move. You really don't know when they took it. They might be on these other agents that affect its potency. All right. Let's forget about that. Is there a lab test we could use to know if they actually have it on board or not?
So there are a few that we can use. There are some that aren't necessarily widely available within some institutions, but we'll talk a little bit about those in a bit. One common test that may be used is the activated partial thromboplastin time, or APTT. A normal APTT indicates that there's little or no drug in the plasma, but you can't really interpret an elevated APTT. The one that's been commonly cited in the literature that may be used to kind of correlate whether or not dabigatran is actually present within the systemic circulation is the thrombin time. And that actually measures the activity of thrombin in the plasma. And it helps with interpreting dabigatran concentrations because it exhibits a linear and concentration-dependent response. So if a patient has a normal TT, it actually tells us that there isn't really a whole lot of significant concentrations of dabigatran present, and you may not necessarily need to reverse in that scenario if the patient isn't clinically bleeding. However, an elevated thrombin time tells us that dabigatran is still present, but we can't really tell how much is actually present, and the extent of that amount being associated with the level of anticoagulation. Other tests that have been used in a number of studies include the dilute thrombin time and the Ekron clotting time. And that exhibits a really strong linear relationship with serum concentrations of dabigatran. However, those tests aren't widely available in most institutions.
Okay. So then let's go into how we are going to go about reversal. Let's talk first if we just went with what the industry would like us to go with. So you have the idealized reversal agent for this medication. What is it? How do we use it?
So the antidote that was recently released and approved by the FDA is called edarasuzumab or Praxbind.
I can't believe you said that. That's so impressive. That's why you get paid the big pharmacy bucks.
Exactly. So edarasuzumab has been marketed as the antidote for reversing coagulopathy associated with dabigatran. How it works, it's a humanized monoclonal antibody. It has a lot more affinity for dabigatran than dabigatran has for thrombin, and so that helps it neutralize the activity of dabigatran. The study that led to its approval, rather accelerated approval by the FDA, was the REVERSE AD study, which was published a couple of years ago. And the investigators enrolled 90 patients with either a serious bleed or if they had a need for urgent invasive procedures within 8 hours while patients were on dabigatran. The investigators used the dilute thrombin time and Ekron clotting time as measuring the level of coagulopathy associated with dabigatran. And what they found was that edarasuzumab completely reversed anticoagulation in over 90% of patients within the first half an hour following the infusion. However, they did report that clinically, cessation of bleeding happened at a median of about 11 and a half hours.
That doesn't sound so great. Though I guess they could blame some of it on the continued reasons for bleeding separate from the anticoagulation.
Correct. So, you know, there is a potential for dabigatran, even in the setting of bleeding, to exhibit sort of a rebound phenomenon as the drug redistributes from the tissues back into the vasculature. And so some of those patients actually exhibited an elevation in the parameters that they used to evaluate dabigatran effects with the dilute thrombin time and Ekron clotting time. So it's not necessarily a perfect agent. And then also within the package insert, it does say that other supportive measures for correcting the bleed may also be used in conjunction with edarasuzumab.
Well, I'm so glad they inserted that there because we wouldn't have figured that out. So they're super helpful. All right. How do we give this? Well, actually, before we get there, how expensive is this?
It's about $3,500 as an estimate.
That's per dose?
That's per dose, okay. Yeah.
And how do we dose it?
So it comes as a package that has 2.5 gram vials, so 2 vials of 2.5 grams each in 50 mLs of solution. The total dose that's to be given is 5 grams administered as the two separate doses. I don't know why they evaluated it like this, but they say that it can be given as an IV push or a quick infusion with separation between doses by no more than 15 minutes. So whether you give one dose via push or quick infusion of 1 vial, quickly followed by the second vial. Again, with a separation time no more than 15 minutes.
Did they say a no less than time? Because that just seems like, why don't I just give it right after the other one?
Or hang both vials simultaneously, yeah. Right? And you can repeat the dose if there is some observation of having a re-elevation in the coagulation parameters or serum concentrations of dabigatran. And that was actually observed in about 25% of patients in the REVERSE AD trial at 12 and 24 hours after administration of this antidote. Again, potentially reflecting the redistribution of dabigatran from the tissues back into the systemic circulation.
Got it. And is there any side effects we need to worry about with this?
There were 5 patients reported to have thrombotic events. A total of 21 patients reported to have, quote, serious adverse effects, though the investigators never described what those events were, based on the, I guess, the positive effects that were observed in the reverse AD trial in clinical practice, I have find a very difficult to kind of correlate the two, since we've observed within the case reports that have been published since its approval, mixed results associated with correcting the bleed associated with zarusuzumab.
Wait, could you clarify that last statement? You said the case reports what have we actually noticed when you say mixed results?
So laboratory parameters may not necessarily correct, requiring redosing of the antidote. And then also, too, some of those case reports have documented use of other supportive measures required in addition to zarusuzumab for it to demonstrate any clinical effect in reversing dabigatran-induced bleed. And that's included agents such as tranexamic acid, perhaps red blood cells, factor 8 inhibitor bypassing activity, or FEBA, as well as intermittent hemodialysis. All of the ones that have been published that have demonstrated positive results have been, not surprisingly, have had some sort of financial relationship with the company, Boehringer Ingelheim.
Well, now I'm getting nervous. So your gut feeling, should we use this? Does it work, or is it a whole lot of crap?
I think we should have it available for use, but I think it's really important to keep in mind that you may need to resort to using some of those other traditional therapies that we had available before zarusuzumab reached the market.
Oh, God. All right. Well, let's talk about some of those then. Let's say you don't have this medication I can't pronounce, which we do actually have, and you have to just go with whatever the hell's in your blood bank and your pharmacy. What actually works?
So it's really hard to say, because a lot of the studies that have been done have been done in vitro or in rabbit's feet or rat tails. But there have been some investigations related to the role of 4-factor PCC, factor 8 inhibitor bypassing activity, and some of the suggestions related to reversing dabigatran-induced intracranial hemorrhage based on the Neurocritical Care Society guidelines that were released last year suggest administering FEBA or 4-factor PCC at a dose of 50 units per kilo to patients with ICH if zarusuzumab isn't available, or if the hemorrhage is associated with a direct thrombin inhibitor other than dabigatran. The guidelines also recommend against administration of FFP or factor 7A, but this is really based on very, very low quality evidence. Intermittent hemodialysis may also be used as an option in patients who present with dabigatran-induced bleed, but just bearing in mind that that can be pretty challenging in initiating in a patient with already hemodynamic instability and trying to get an access for starting dialysis, but it has been done in a number of case reports and case series. And
all right, we're just about to go into the Zabans. Before we get there, just a real quick question. At your shop, patient intracranial hemorrhage on Coumadin, you're using 4-factor PCC and vitamin K, I assume. Yes?
Yes. Right. Yes.
Because there's still people out there, there's still neurosurgeons out there, I know, because occasionally I have to deal with them, who just don't believe in this and still want to go with FFP, which is crazy in my mind. And I don't know why. I don't know why. But yes. So that's the Neurocritical Care Society's recommendations, and it's the recommendations of pretty much every group I've seen come out about it. If you have a bleed in your head that needs emergent reversal, it just makes sense to do something that actually works and is quick.
And there's some new stuff that's been coming out that we're probably going to be implementing at our own institution in the coming months related to using fixed doses of 4-factor PCC as opposed to the weight-based dosing recommended by the manufacturer in warfarin-induced coagulopathy. So as opposed to using, you know, up to 10 vials in a patient who's bigger and who has an elevated INR, getting away with 2 to 3 vials of 4-factor PCC, so 1,000 to 1,500 units, may be something that we're going to be exploring.
Yep, we've been doing it, and it's worked very nicely. We just go with the 1,500 in patients we don't have an INR back yet, and most of the time, when we repeat the INR, We've gotten full reversal. So I think it's a great way to go.
Cool.
All right, let's talk about the Zabans. Things like rivaroxaban. I'm sure you know all the meds in this class. I can't even begin to name them all, but I think they all pretty much work the same way, right? Factor 10
right.
inhibitors. Okay, right. So patient comes in on that, and you get the CT scan, intracranial bleed. How long after taking those meds do we have to worry about reversal?
So for rivaroxaban, with oral ingestion, peak effects happen within 2 to 4 hours. It does have a half-life of 16 to 13 hours in patients with adequate kidney function. Two-thirds of the parent drug gets biotransformed into inactive metabolites, and the rest is eliminated unchanged in the urine. Bearing in mind, though, that with rivaroxaban, again, there is a potential for drug-drug interactions, particularly with not only the P-glycoprotein inhibitors, but we also have to worry about those agents that are substrates for CYP3A4, the CYP3A4 enzyme. So this includes agents like our azole antifungals, our macrolides, as well as some of our HIV meds.
All right. So again, difficult to do by timing. How about a lab test? Is there a lab test we could get that's actually available that would tell us, oh, don't need to reverse this patient?
So with the factor 10A inhibitors, prothrombin time is actually more sensitive at higher concentrations of rivaroxaban, but it does have a poor correlation of sensitivity with the other two factor 10A inhibitors, apixaban and edoxaban. It's great having a prothrombin time that's widely available in pretty much any institution that you go to. Anti-factor 10A may correlate with plasma concentrations of factor 10A inhibitors, but it does require calibration. There are other tests that may be used, a lot of them not widely available in most institutions, but available in those studies that investigate antidotes for using for bleeding associated with these factor 10A inhibitors. This includes tests such as the dilute prothrombin time, chromogenic anti-factor 10A, which I think is really neat because there is direct proportionality with color change and the concentration of factor 10A present. And then we have another test known as the prothrombinase-induced clotting time.
Of course, I order that every day. okay, so the test may or may not be helpful depending on what your institution has, but if I have to guess, you're not going to have the ones that are really accurate. So now we decide we're going to reverse. And if we went with the nice, expensive, new, shiny one, tell me in the future what we'll be using if the industry has its way.
In the future. So this agent, Andexanet Alpha, binds and sequesters factor 10A inhibitors within the vascular space, and that helps restore the activity of endogenous factor 10A. And as a result of that, it reduces the level of anticoagulant activity. There were two parallel randomized placebo-controlled trials that were published related to its use in healthy volunteers, the Annexa-A, which evaluated its use with apixaban, and the Annexa-R, which evaluated its use with rivaroxaban. It's kind of a pain in the butt to dose with the Annexa-A trial. They used a 400 milligram bolus with a continuous infusion of 4 milligrams a minute for 120 minutes. With the apixaban, with rivaroxaban, the investigators used an 800 milligram IV bolus with a continuous infusion of 8 milligrams a minute for 2 hours. Compared to placebo, obviously, Andexanet, not surprisingly, significantly reduced anti-factor 10A, increased thrombin generation, and decreased the amount of unbound drug concentration within the apixaban and rivaroxaban group. The thing about this agent is that the initial reduction in anti-factor 10A was seen minutes after the bolus injection, but it was short-lived because it does have a short half-life of about 1 hour. However, when given with the continuous infusion, the suppression of anti-factor 10A activity actually persisted for the duration of the infusion. It's really unclear, though, whether that amount of reversal is sufficient for patients with factor 10A inhibitor-induced major bleeding. And what's that?
I said, ugh, it sounds like yet another.
Right.
You know, you're paying a lot of money and you're getting somewhat shoddy results.
If it becomes available, this is another agent that might be a bit cumbersome. It does require reconstitution. It is available in vials of 100 milligrams. With the low dose and the high dose regimens, up to 18 vials were used. So imagine reconstituting that within your emergency department. I don't know where you'd find the space.
Yeah, sounds like another dantrolene type situation.
And it does require refrigeration. So, yeah. And it's not FDA approved. It's, you know, the FDA actually said we actually need a little bit more studies to evaluate these patients who require urgent reversal. And we just don't know how fast or the extent of reversal activity that it will carry within the clinical setting. So we'll see what happens with it. I think it'll probably be making its way to the market. But again, it's going to be a pain in the butt to get in your emergency department, get approved, reconstitute, and actually be able to administer in the patient.
Now, the optimistic thing is that the Zabans, at least from my understanding, actually do have a conventionally available reversal agent in the setting of the four-factor PCCs. So does K-Centra work, Nad?
I believe it does. We've had a lot of good clinical evaluations conducted related to using four-factor PCC for reversing the factor 10A inhibitors. If you have the fancy schmancy tests available for evaluating its effectiveness, there has been demonstration of completely reversing some of these clotting times. Some of the results in other studies are mixed. However, the recommendations, again, from the neurocritical care guidelines is suggested use of four-factor PCC at 50 units per kilo, or if you don't have that available, using activated PCC or FIBA, both at doses of 5 units per kilo. Can we get away with lower doses? It's really hard to tell. Again, you're putting these patients at risk of experiencing a thrombotic event with these agents, by the very nature of the fact that you're giving them activated factors. And so whether or not we can get away with lower doses is, you know, something that's been raised recently. There was one study just published in the Journal of Emergency Medicine that evaluated FIBA for four-factor 10A inhibitor-induced intracranial hemorrhage. The investigators used a dose of 20 units per kilo of FIBA, and a little over half of the patients in that case series showed stable ICH. But even so, even with that low dose, two patients actually experienced thromboembolic events with administration.
Yeah, now let's be really clear for the listeners. When you read these studies and you say, oh my God, FIBA, there were thrombotic events, it's a horrible drug, you have to be very careful because these were patients who required anticoagulation for some reason, which means they're predisposed to clot. So until you see a study with a comparison group of patients who had their reversal done by some other means versus FIBA, or in the case of the K-Centra versus FFP trials, unless there's a direct comparison, then you can't believe that there's any attributable increase in thrombotic events. For instance, when you look at some of the K-Centra series without a comparison group of FFP, there was, of course, thrombotic events. But then when they did the trial that led to K-Centra's approval, FFP versus K-Centra, there was no difference between the groups in terms of thrombotic events. So, of course, FIBA is going to have thrombotic events because you're reversing someone's anticoagulation. It doesn't mean those events are attributable to the agent itself as opposed to just reversing a patient.
Right. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, is another agent that's kind of on the horizon for reversing not only factor 10A inhibitors, but we're talking unfractionated heparin, low molecular weight heparin, and abigatran. And that's known as eripazine, also known as seraparantag, or PER977. This is a synthetic water-soluble cationic molecule that's been designed to help reverse the anticoagulant effects of these agents. The reversal effect, however, can't be monitored with routine tests for coagulation. Interestingly enough, because this agent actually binds to citrate, which is the anticoagulant used when you're collecting blood for routine tests of anticoagulation or when anti-factor 10A assays are ordered. And so as a result, the measure that's to be used to monitor its effects is the whole blood clotting time. If it's approved, it doesn't require reconstitution, it doesn't require refrigeration, and it's available or will be available in vials containing 300 milligrams of the antidote. And with that agent, based on a study that was published in New England Journal a couple of years back, doses that were used were anywhere from 100 to 300 milligrams of this PER-977, with some pretty good results in correcting the not only the labs, but also cessation of bleeding.
Wow. Well, that sounds intriguing. Do we have any idea of what the cost will be, or it's too early for that?
I think it's too early. I wouldn't be surprised if it's up somewhere in the $3,000-$5,000 range.
Sure. And is this one that also is going to, when it wears off, they're going to re-anticoagulate, or we don't know that yet?
I think it's still too early to tell.
All right. Well, that sounds exciting, though. It's the first one you've mentioned that actually sounds like, wow, this will be helpful.
And who knows, it may take over use of azacitidine and potentially andexanet alpha if it ever comes to market.
All right. Anything we missed that you want to add, Nats?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. This was fantastic. I know when I'm out of my depth and I have to get experts to explain all these names I can't pronounce and various cytochrome systems. So I can't thank you enough.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, folks, there you have it. Hopefully that helps. And if it doesn't, let me know in the comments. I will make a request of all of you. If you haven't done it lately or you haven't done it ever, please go to iTunes and rate the show. It actually still matters even on these established podcasts. The iTunes hierarchy is very weird. And if you are not getting ratings, even though thousands and thousands and thousands of people are listening to the show, then you move way down in the iTunes rankings, which is kind of silly and maybe change because very soon a whole new Apple architecture is coming out. And I think your listener numbers will actually count for a whole lot more. But until then, do me a favor, just rank us in iTunes if you like the podcast. If you don't like the podcast, you could rank us as well, but I prefer you actually send me an email and tell me why, because I would immediately take that information to heart and potentially improve the podcast. Okay, that's enough for now. Scott Weingart, MCRIP Podcast, saying bye-bye.